Here we go, first question. You are teaching Buddhism to the Westerners, especially the developed world like Australia. Is it developed? Maybe materially it's developed, but spiritually it's underdeveloped, very poor. But why in Buddha's birth country, India, the majority of population live under the poverty? Are they poor? Materially poor, but sometimes spiritually rich. Do you think they are happy? Ask them. Countries like India, Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia are eager to change, and they apparently want to copy the Western industrialized path at the moment. What do you think? Again, having lived in a very poor part of Thailand for the first 9 years of my life, no roads, no electricity, and one of my memories, which I can visualize it now, was going into the local village to do a ceremony for somebody. And the houses were on stilts, underneath were the water buffalo, on top were the family. And as they went into the village, this was seen every evening, they had the whole family, and so many extras were staying there. Uncles, grandparents, nephews, nieces, maybe about 18 or 19 people. And every evening after their supper, they'll be sitting around in a semicircle. They had a kerosene oil lamp, and all it was a bowl with the kerosene in, and they used the top of a toothpaste tube, put an old rag through the center, floating on the oil, and they lit it, and that was their light. And it also, very smoky, kept the mosquitoes away, very efficient, and the whole family would be sitting around that little oil lamp every evening, telling jokes, old stories, lies, anything. And the same ones probably every night, and you could see the smiles on the whole huge family. When I saw that, I saw this is an undeveloped country. They developed this beautiful family who would be with one another every evening, telling stories and jokes and tales. And how deprived I was when I grew up having a TV. But fortunately, in those days, we only had two channels on the TV. How deprived is modern society when you can get Foxtel News or something, where you get 6,400 channels, and still people get bored. And because of arguments, every room has another TV, which means if you don't like the channel you're looking at now, you can go to another room and look at something else. That modern life is separating our families. Those of you who grew up in a small apartment, who shared a room with your siblings, if you were really lucky, and shared a bed with all your sisters. You didn't get much sleep, but you learned how to love one another. These days, we have big houses and mansions. Somebody sent me the article. There was a woman in England who won the lottery, £42 million. Straight, no taxes. So she bought this huge mansion in the countryside. She sold it within a year at a great loss because she said the big house was separating her family. Her husband was in one wing of the house. She was in another. Her children each had their own rooms. She never saw the people she loved. And so she sold that and bought a tiny house so she could see her husband and her kids many times every day. And I can appreciate the value of small things. We only get big things to show how wealthy we are, how successful we are, and how stupid we are. Small is beautiful. Small houses mean you have to learn how to get on together. And you learn how to tolerate other people, because you can't escape. I grew up in the same room with my brother. Now for 16, 17, 18 years until he went to get a job and got a flat with his friends. And so I became a monk. He became a banker. So I don't think he actually admitted on his CV when he applied for his jobs in the bank that his brother was a monk, because that would not sound good. I was totally against sort of wealth, and there he was pursuing wealth. But because, you know, we spent so much time together as young, yeah, we fought, we got that over early in our life. Now we love each other to bits. So, you know, next October I'll be going to see him in London. And I always put that down to the fact that we had to, because we're in the same room together, day in, day out, for years. So I always say big houses destroy, you know, the family bonds of love and tolerance and resilience. And so then when we, if your kids are in their own room, then when they leave home and find a partner, they don't know how to love one another, to be resilient, to compromise. Because they never learn that when they grow up. So, it's wonderful having people all together, like the old days in India, Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia. So close together. Your family was so important. They'd always look after you. And, you know, you didn't need healthcare, because you had so many sisters and brothers and nurses to look after you. But much of the health care was provided by your family. That was just, and you didn't need even insurance. Someone was sick, someone lost their job. There'd be so many other places to look after you, care for you, give you a bed, feed you. We've lost a lot of that. So sometimes I argue this. Developed world, are we really that developed in the United States? My slogan, if ever I did run for the president of the United States, would be, make United States poor again. And make it value just living together much more. Because wealth actually divides us. I look at it that way. Anyway, perhaps some dosage of detaching from materialism can make the people in the West happier. But a great amount of people in the East desire to drive cars and live under the air conditioners. Are there any middle ground between the West and the East? Yeah, of course, there's this wisdom. That's the East, the West. So I live in Australia. It's neither East nor the West. It's the South. And it's great that, you know, we intermarry, you know, that we live in each other's countries. And so our cultures, they do intermix. And the best is to take the best out of every culture, not take the worst. And those cultural things which you learn is, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, in countries like India and Thailand and Cambodia, there's a lot of sexual exploitation of children, which is gross. It's unacceptable. That would not happen in developed countries. But it happens there. So that is the worst of those countries. And I just cannot understand why some of these are Buddhist countries and they tolerate that, which is just unbelievable. But, you know, we all have our faults, we all have our strong points. We can take the best of the US Western culture, take the best of Asian culture, the best of Southern culture, and mix all those up together. Take the best. Just like, you know, going to the restaurants. You don't just eat English food because you're born in England. You don't eat Italian food because you're born in Italian. You take the best of each. Just like I said the other day, strawberry ice cream on spaghetti. Fusion. On YouTube you said, whose Dang Is had a different name in Asia. Can you tell the story of this? Whose Dang Is, something had a different name in Asia. I can't remember that one. Any help? Oh, the book. I thought you meant, like the dung. It's a different name in Asia. Anyone here from Thailand? Okay. Because, you know, even Ajahn Chah, John in the back would say this is true. He would use that, you know, the equivalent word for shit was ki. And they use that word so often. And Ajahn Chah used to say that. You know, they have really interesting names. Very earthy language. Like ki neo means literally sticky shit. And that means a euphemism for someone who's really stingy, who never gives any donations, never supports a TS. They're sticky shit. Or in Laos. In Laos, a young boy, a young kid, maybe 7 or 8 years of age, was called Hum Noi. And it literally meant small testicles. It was such an earthy culture. You know, it was not sort of trying to sort of be polite or anything. And it was just such a relief and so fresh. You know, that we didn't have to worry about what we said to anybody. So anyway, in the Asian edition of the Truckload of Dying, opening the door of your heart, everyone has a different name. The one in Indonesia, I think I was talking about, was the worm and its filthy love. And that particular story, which is, as again, it's another shit story, but very important. And that was about the two monks who were best friends together. And when they died, one of them got reborn in a beautiful heavenly realm. Whether you believe in all this stuff or not is irrelevant. This is a beautiful story. Been in a wonderful heaven realm. And the other one, because of some bad karma, got reborn as a worm in a pile of cow shit. Now, the heavenly being was enjoying himself up in heaven for a while, and then thought, where's my friend? Where's he been reborn? And so he used his powers, his heavenly powers, and looked at all the heavenly realms. Couldn't find his friend anywhere. So I thought, he must have been reborn as a human being. The human life is a very special one. So he looked around all the human beings and couldn't find his friend anywhere. Oh my goodness. He hasn't been reborn as an animal. So he looked upon all the animals, you know, the lions and the tigers and the gorillas, and couldn't find him there anywhere. Where's he gone? So he checked the realm of the creepy crawlies. And there, he found, to his shock and horror, his best friend had been reborn as a worm in a pile of cow shit. Now, the bonds of friendship are almost, you know, so strong, they're almost unbreakable. So he decided to go and rescue his friend. He went down to that steaming, stinky, hot pile of cow dung. And this is a heavenly being, okay? This is really heavy. Imagine, you know, the Queen Elizabeth just going out in front of cow dung. But that's a sacrifice you make. So, in front of the cow dung, he shouted out, "Hey, worm, worm, come out." And this little worm poked there. "Yeah, what do you want?" He said, "We used to be the best friends together in our previous life. You know, we used to hang out together, eat together, meditate together, and now because of some unfortunate mistake, you've been reborn as a worm in a pile of shit. I'm in a heaven realm. I've come to rescue you. Come with me to heaven." And the worm said, "Hang on a moment. In heaven, is there any cow shit?" "Of course not. We don't have filthy, stinky stuff like that in heaven." "Well, if that's the case, I'm not going. I like my shit. It's my food. It's delicious. It's warm. And it's my home. He said, you don't understand, said the heavenly being. Up in heaven it's much better, more fragrant, cleaner, more delicious food. He said, I don't believe you. I like my shit. Get away. And there's no way the heavenly being could convince this worm to let go of his filthy love of dung. You can understand why. That's where worms live. That's, they like it there. So, the heavenly being said, well, I can't just give up that easily. I've got to be a little bit more aggressive. So the worm, you know, with his beautiful, fragrant, clean hands, grab hold of the worm and try to pull it out of the lump of shit. Now, that worm, number one, didn't want to go. Number two, was covered with all this slimy stuff. So when it wriggled and writhed, it easily slipped out of the grasp of the heavenly being and went right inside the pile of dung, to the deepest, inaccessible part. But when you really love and care for someone, you just don't give up. That heavenly being put his hand into the deepest, stinkiest parts, looking for that worm, feeling for it, until it found it and pulled it out again. But every time it pulled it out, the worm went back in again. It escaped, pulled it out, and went back in again. Until eventually, the heavenly being had to leave the worm to his pile of cow shit. And that is a simile for attachment. The Buddha spent so much time trying to pull you all out of your filthy bosom. And will you go? No. I like my filthy shit. That's a gross coarse simile, but it's very accurate. You try and get someone to stop smoking, to stop having alcohol, to stop getting angry, to stop getting negative. You try, you get a little way, no, we go back again. So that was the title of the Indonesian version, and it really took off. So that was a really, really bestseller. Everyone, and to this day, the Indonesian students, they all refer to me as the teacher of worms. And they don't call me disciple. They don't call themselves disciples. They say, we're little worms stuck in our shit, and you're our teacher. That's really funny, but anyway, that's where that comes from. What is the best practice I can teach my 6 and 10 year old daughters? You teach them to be kind, compassionate, and trust your children. You don't trust them enough. And don't teach them through a fear. If you don't pass your get good grades, you'll be punished. You don't do that. You give incentives. There was a car traveling along one of the highways in the US, and a motorcycle priest just came up to it and said, pull over, sir. And the driver was a bit concerned, but then the policeman said, no, we stop this nonsense of fining people for bad driving. Instead, we decide to use positive reinforcement. I've been following you. You've been driving sensibly within the speed limit, wearing your seatbelt, and I'm authorized to give you $1,000 prize for good driving. So encourage good behavior rather than bad behavior. And the policeman said, congratulations, sir. And now for our newsletter, we have to ask people, you know, if, you know, when you win this $1,000 for good, sensible driving, how will you use that money? He said, well, with $1,000, I think I can take some driving lessons and get a license. And his wife, sitting in the seat, said, don't believe him. He's always like that when he's drunk. And the kid in the back said, it's amazing. I didn't think we'd get so far in a stolen car. So, for your daughters, get them positive reinforcement. And they might find out what they're really up to. Now, actually, with kids in the US and in all other similar cultures. Because I remember just being on the back of a bus, just coming from one appointment to another, and the school time was out. So I was listening to how children talk to each other. There were two young girls. And honestly, their conversation went, these were friends. So you never get a boyfriend. No, your nose is too big. Yeah, and you got flat breasts. You won't get a boyfriend either. And the whole journey was two friends criticizing one another. When I heard that, you understood the problem with youth. At school, you never do good enough in the class. And even your friends, let alone your enemies, are always putting you down, criticizing you. When they get home, what do they get from their mum and dad? Your room's not clean enough. Spending too much time doing computer games. It's always criticism, criticism, criticism. You can understand why children just rebel. And they feel they're never good enough. If you want to find this out, and you've got kids, just, you know, keep it like on your iPhone or a piece of paper. Write down every time you criticize your kids and every time you praise them. See if you can understand what your children hear. And understand why kids sometimes get depressed and feel they're not good enough. So, praise your kids as much as you can. Praise goes a huge way. When you think you're teaching your kids to clean their room, you're encouraging your kids to actually to do better at school. It doesn't work that way. They just get depressed and feel hopeless. When I was a school teacher for 1 year, at the end of the year, when I gave out the report cards, one of the kids in my class came bottom. Bottom of the class. 30 kids, they came bottom. Even if you had a class of Einsteins, one of them would have to come bottom. It's well known that half of children are below average intelligence. It has to be. That's what average means. But not your kids. Oh, no, 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 no. Other kids, okay. So, this kid came bottom. And as soon as I gave out, you know, the results of the exams, this kid, he read his exam and you can see him get depressed. The body language was so easy to spot. Head down, shoulders drooped. And you could understand what was going through his head. You know, how he'd be criticized from his friends. Your dummy. Dummy of the class. And what he would get from his parents. All his privileges revoked. You better do better next year. And I was a compassionate, kind teacher. They all knew I was a Buddhist at the time. So I went up to this kid out of kindness and compassion. And I taught him some Buddhism. About the Bodhisattva. I said to him, in Buddhism, we have this being called a bodhisattva who sacrifices their own happiness and well-being for the sake of others. And that is what you have done this year. Deliberately, intentionally, you've taken this rotten position of bottom of the class so none of your friends will have to suffer what you're going to get from your parents this evening. You are my hero. And I am going to the principal's office right after this class, and I'm going to recommend you for the Bodhisattva of the Year prize in this school. All your friends are so arrogant, you know, they just think about themselves, trying to come top. You're the only one here who has compassion. You are a Bodhisattva. And I remember him looking at me as if I was the craziest teacher he'd ever had in all school. But at least it took him out of his depression. And I did remind him that in this school, you're only allowed to get the Bodhisattva prize once. So next year, let somebody else come bottom of the class. But all it meant to do was actually to take off this idea that because you come bottom, you're worthless. That the only way to feel good about yourself is to succeed. That is so much bullshit. So, what is success and what is failure? When I was young, I believed that too. You had to be successful before you became happy. Pass your exams and then you'd be happy. I told that story last night. Then I read books like Daniel Goleman's Emotional Intelligence, which said the opposite. It said, no, be happy, and whatever you do, do a job you have passion for, and then you'll be successful. And I found out that was bullshit too. And you finally understood that happiness is not the cause, is not the path to success. Success is not the path to happiness. Happiness is success. So if you're happy now, in this moment, you're successful. Anyone who's happy right now, you've arrived. Baby, you've arrived. If you understand that, that's a huge insight into the meaning of life. Happiness is success. So, well done. Enjoy it. You've made it. Yay! So that is with your kids. And if the kids, you know, get graded at grade school, I suppose that's what grade school means, A, B, C, D, E, F, did anyone ever explain to your kids what those letters stand for? F stands for fantastic. E stands for excellent. A stands for arrogant. Undermine the system. Kids love me when I say that. And anyway, if any of you are out and out Buddhists, right, there's a few Sri Lankans here and Cambodians, and if you're out and out Buddhists, if your kid comes in the top 5% at school, or in the bottom 5%, you are not good Buddhist parents. You're not good. In Buddhism, we practice the middle way. So if your kid comes in the middle somewhere, then they're good Buddhists. And the kids quote that to their parents. And Sajjan Mom said, I'm in the middle, Mum. That's the best. Give kids a break. They're trying their best and so much pressure on them. I don't know why this isn't better known. I don't know how the US education system rates according to other OECD countries. But one of the highest ranking countries consistently is Finland. And I know this from one of the Finnish monks. You don't start school until you're 7. There are no preschools or kindergartens. So first 7 years, you play with your friends. And from 7 until the university entrance, you never ever have homework. You never take any work back after school. You play after school. And that makes the highest ranking educational achievements on children. It's totally against what is taught in educational psychology in US and even much more so in places like Singapore and China. China, mainland China, is the worst. Much more than Singapore and Hong Kong. Kids have mental breakdowns, suicides, psychosis at a very early age. It's child abuse. They get forced and pressured so much. You've heard of tiger mums. That is child abuse. I'm sorry, but I'm going to be quite strong on that. And you got the evidence of this education system in Finland. We get high rankings in math and science and other stuff, and also the kids socially engaged, emotionally stable. They play. When I see, and I used to work hard, but always had time to play soccer with your friends. You know, go out in the summertime, go out in the morning, wouldn't see your mum till the evening. Just playing with your friends, exploring, getting into adventures. Kids are deprived when they can't do that. That is a huge problem. And Finland, good on it, has found an answer. And it works. Your kids, when they come home and homework, stressed out. Poor things. Anyway, if the mind naturally keeps wandering off all the time in meditation to the future past, how do you bring it back to the breath? On one hand, you want to focus breath, and on the other hand, you want to force the mind. I used to teach that and do that. The mind wanders off, bring it back. Wanders off, bring it back. Wanders off, bring it back. And it wouldn't stay. And after a while, I think something's going wrong here. It's just endless, very frustrating. And then that's what I said. You ask, why does the mind wander off? Find the cause. Don't use willpower. Why? And that's why I developed like the story I said earlier about the being invited to a cup of coffee, being told what to eat and what to drink. Of course you don't want to hang out with people like that. And that's what you do to your mind. Come on, watch the breath. So instead, there was this really amazing mother who told me this story in Australia. She had a 6-year-old son who threw a tantrum. I forget what it's all about, but the kid said, "Mum, I don't love you anymore. I'm leaving home." So what did the mum do? She said, "Okay, darling, I'll help you pack." So went to the bedroom and helped the kid pack all the essentials of life. Spider-Man suit, teddy bear. Let your kid pack his own suitcase and see what he puts in there. But, and the mum said, "Oh, before you go, darling, and I'll make you a sandwich, because, you know, your life is a long time, you need something to eat." So I packed the favourite sandwich, peanut butter and jelly or something, and put it in a nice little bag, and then it waved the son off at the door of the house. "Bye-bye, darling, have a wonderful life." And there she describes seeing her 6-year-old son, a little suitcase in one hand, brown paper bag in the other, walking off into its life. It went to the end of the little garden path, opened the gate, turned left and down the street. Off the first time it left home. 6-year-old. Got about 100 yards, before it felt terribly homesick. Turned around, went to the garden gate, down the path, and the mother was waiting there, hadn't moved. "Welcome home, darling." That is emotional intelligence. If you let it go with love, it always comes back. So that's the same when your mind wanders off. "Off you go, mind. Have a nice time. See you back later." Pack its bags, give it its favorite sandwich, and let it go. If you love your mind, and the mind recognizes you, give it that freedom, it would always come back, pretty soon. Who wants to run away from such a beautiful mother like that? Of course you never do. So that is the same as how you use your mind. Now, a personal story. I don't know if I would have told you this, John, I'm not sure. Maybe just after you left or before you left. No, you must have heard me tell you this story. When I was on my Tudong year, that's after 5 years, went off to... Oh, what time is it? Oh, yeah, 1:30, okay. So it's quite a few. I've only done 4 questions so far. So when I left the monastery just wandering around, I found this idyllic place in the north of Thailand, It was idyllic for an English monk because it was right in the middle of a tea plantation. As much tea as I could ever drink, all for free. That was just, oh, an English monk's dream. If you're American, you have to find a coffee plantation somewhere. But anyway, there I was, and everything was just so perfect. Nice weather, good food, no one bothering me. But then my mind started wandering, became restless. And at that time, I didn't understand what to do. So I tried to fight my mind. And it started getting more and more crazy. And I didn't have anyone to talk to give me some advice. So it got worse and worse. And I started thinking what you can only call like unmonkish thoughts. Thoughts of old girlfriends. I wonder if she's available. Stop it! Stop it! Sexual fantasies. And I was a good monk. I'm committed. Now, John, you know that. I don't want to do anything else, but these things came in. And every time I tried to push them out, they just burst through again and obsessed my mind. And it was so incredibly tiring and frustrating to fight your mind. And in the end, close to the end, I just got so frustrated, didn't know what to do. My mind was driving me crazy. And so there was a Buddha statue, you know, in one, the hall there. I bowed to it and basically said, help. Call the helpline. And an idea came up. And the idea was, because, you know, trade in the West, do a deal. You know, the Trump solution. So the deal was this. You know, if my mind wanted to think of, you know, stupid thoughts, I'd let it think whatever it wanted from 3 to 4 p.m. every afternoon. The rest of the time it will behave. That's fair enough. You know, so you have an hour, think your sexy time, sexy thoughts, whatever you want to think of, I will accept it, not stop it, but the rest of the time, be a monk. So I tried that. It didn't work the way I expected it, because when I tried to watch my breath, the same stuff would come up again. I tried to force it out, it would come up again. When it got to 3 o'clock, I went out to my hut, just leaned against the wall, put my feet out and said, okay, whatever you want to think about, the most weird, perverted, fetish, fantasy, whatever goes, I won't stop anything. And this is honest truth. The next hour, I watched every breath without missing one. And that blew me away. What the heck is going on? Why, when I tried to control the mind, it went crazy. When I let it be, it was peaceful. That taught me how to deal with a restless mind. The reason I got into those crazy thoughts, because I was trying to stop them. And the more I tried to stop them, the crazier they became. You try that. For many people, it's counterintuitive because we think controlling is going to get to where we want to be. But when you let go and are kind, you'll find your mind doesn't want to leave you. It doesn't need the crazy thoughts. Let it be. Here we go, anyway. Some Buddhists criticize the mindfulness movement because it focuses only on mindfulness and removes essential Buddhist teachings, such as ethical living. What are your thoughts on this issue? It's the last time I was in Canada, I went to Halifax, which is the hometown of Shambhala, and I was invited there, and I actually talked about that issue. And John Kabat-Zinn had just been there about a month before I arrived there, and he too was concerned about that. This is a fellow who started the mindfulness movement. He is a Buddhist. And he wanted to try and somehow restore the other parts of the Buddhist practice to mindfulness. And as I said, I think even this morning, mindfulness is not enough. I think it was yesterday, kindfulness. Now that's a start, a bit of Buddhist compassion, and also the virtue as well. That's all necessary there. And the stillness, and the good foundation of you. So all that is, we're not criticizing, it's starting something. And that's what John Kabat-Zinn kept on saying. If he called it meditation, it wouldn't have got much traction, especially in a country like United States. But calling it mindfulness, making it secular, was a way of introducing it to people, making it more palatable. So, yeah, you can criticize anything, but you can also praise it. Don't look at the two bad bricks in the wall. Look at the 998 good bricks of the mindfulness movement. But what I'm really concerned about the mindfulness movement, now you have to be accredited to teach mindfulness. So I'm going to soon be banned. I've got no accreditation. Anyway, self-destructive people sometimes are often care for themselves in a self-destructive way. Anger, aggression, alcohol, that's not care. They sometimes often blame their self-destructive behavior on a lack of caring from others. If you cared more for me, things wouldn't be like this. If you loved me, I wouldn't be upset. How do one care for such a person without enabling, promoting their self-destructive behavior? And it's good insight there. Self-destructive behavior, addictions, always a sign of lack of self-worth. So the last thing you want to do is to stigmatize them. If they have self-destructive behavior, you will notice it's not 24/7. Focused on the other part of them, which is not self-destructive. I've been in prisons many times, in all the prisons of the world. I've never been in a prison in US, but UK, Australia, obviously, Singapore, been in Changi Jail, which is very tough. All those times I've been in the prisons, I've never seen a murderer. I've never seen a thief. Never seen a rapist. I've never even seen a criminal inside jail. All the time I've only seen a person who's murdered. A person who's raped, but not a rapist. Why is it that we forget about all the other things they've done in their life? And as soon as you get what I mean there, you understand the way for rehabilitation. If you focus on the one bad thing you've done, it's hurt a lot of people, and you as well. But that's not the totality of who you are. And right now, in that carnet just up the road from our monastery, there's a murderer there, finishes his sentence, who realizes he's not a murderer. He read that book, story, The Two Bad Bricks. He said, it's only two murders. It's only two murders. It's only two murders. And that is his two bad bricks. All the other people, the 998 people he didn't murder. When I told that story in Singapore at a mental health conference, after the conference, this guy came up and he said he's one of the professors there and he wanted to invite me to bless his ward. I said, well, what is your department here? Schizophrenia. He was the head of the schizophrenia unit in Singapore. And he said, I'm a Catholic, but still, I really appreciate what you've taught, so come and bless my ward. And I said, well, how do you treat schizophrenia in Singapore? He said, I don't. Just like you said, Ajahn Brahm, I treat the other part of my patient, which isn't schizophrenic. And that just really went to my heart. And, John, that I'm not really supposed to put my hands up and worship a layperson. I did it to him. It was wonderful. What he said was brilliant. Because that's one of the problems. People have schizophrenic behavior and you call them a schizophrenic. And they become a schizophrenic. You diagnose someone with OCD, you're OCD. And they become OCD. You're a person, a being who's much more than the OCD. Much more than the schizophrenia. Focus on the other part. And I asked this fellow, what's the results? And he smiled. I always like to ask questions which I know the answer to, simply because I want it reaffirmed so I can quote him. And he said, much better than conventional treatments. I thought it was brilliant. That, you know, this philosophy, this way of looking, actually helps. So I think you all know you probably all know some people who are schizophrenic. It's how difficult that is. But they're not always schizophrenic. Don't stigmatize them. They're more than that. If you don't know that, you understand just how to deal with all sorts of things in life. There is no such thing as a terrorist. It's people who do terrorist acts. I know that might be controversial, but that's what my wisdom says, and that offers a solution. Water the flowers in the garden, don't water the weeds. Your husband may not be perfect. Just ignore that. Focus on the beautiful part of him. The stuff which you really respect. And you find that he shows you more of that. Yourself. Stop obsessing about all your faults and failures. Start obsessing about all the wonderful things you've done in your life. All the beauty, all your goodness and kindness. Focus on that. And that grows. You feel good about yourself. So you don't need those addictions anymore. Why do I want to run away from this beautiful person? I imagine I am. Anyway, I fall asleep a lot when I meditate. How can I not do this besides drinking coffee beforehand? Look, what's wrong with falling asleep when you meditate? Don't stress out about that. At least you're sitting here. You're not doing any harm to anybody when you're falling asleep. You're not robbing banks or actually, I love the nice stories in the newspapers are the ones which are really funny. And this apparently happened in New York about the guy who was robbing a convenience store, pulled out a gun, and asked for the contents of the cash register, late at night. And the woman behind the counter, she was really smart. She handed over the contents of the cash register, and he saw a bottle of whiskey on the shelf. He said, I'll take that too. And she said, I'm sorry, sir, you're not old enough to have the whiskey. He said, I am. He said, no, you're not. So she said, show me your ID. And this stupid young man showed the ID. You see, I'm 21. Look, it says it on my driving license. Oh, I'm terribly sorry, sir. It's right, you are. I'm 21. Here, have the alcohol. I'm sorry. And as he went out, had all the details, rang the police, was arrested in a half an hour. That's a smart person. So when you fall asleep, when you meditate, the only reason you do that is because of sleep deficit. You're tired. And your brain is giving you a message. It needs to be quiet and sleep for a while. Let it. If you fight it, you get stressed, fear of failure. You don't love yourself. You're trying to control yourself. Let yourself be sleepy. It soon passes when you don't fight it. When it does pass, you're clear and happy. It's natural. So just let it be. Stop judging yourself. It's all right to fall asleep. Last night you mentioned that the five senses are a burden that hamper us from accessing the sixth mental mind state. It seems to me that often it is a mind state deluded that hampers us the most. Can you please discuss it? It is not the mind, it's the stupidity which lives in the mind. The mind itself is pure, it's wonderful. So you don't judge the US governmental system on the occupants of the current government. Like the mind is much bigger than all of that. So, It's when you do let the five senses go, with that goes a lot of the stupidity, and you will find that your mind is the purest, most beautiful thing. But that really shocks people. Now, all this other stuff is just overlaid. When you sort of go inside of the lotus, it's beautiful. And that is a wonderful thing to understand, just how beautiful you can be. If shit can be beautiful, you can. Is absolute faith in rebirth a prerequisite in following the Buddha's teachings? No. You don't have to believe in rebirth in this life because you will in your next. That's an old joke. That's a good one. It is the one leap of faith, so to speak, in Buddhism. If so, why? As it seems to me that it then seems a question of crime and being afraid of the punishment in the case of the Buddhist, not meted out by a creator God, nevertheless a fear of punishment. Why not practice the path that is just beneficial at least? Of course, whether there is rebirth or not, it's still worth being a good person because it's fun being good. But as a physicist, theoretical physicist, a hard-nosed scientist, I am passionately opposed to scientists who refuse to actually to see the evidence, which is they're out there convincing that there's such a thing as rebirth. It's out there. But why people don't believe it, this is one of the reasons why. I mentioned this to John earlier. One of my best friends at college together, this is the guy I mentioned last night, who was a very close friend, but also a close disciple of Professor Stephen Hawking. Even Stephen Hawking went to this guy's marriage with Marie. It's a Japanese girl, very nice girl. And he told me of an experiment which was done. Did I mention this last night, the flower pot experiment? Okay. This must have been in Tibet House in Manhattan. The flower pot experiment. One of his friends, who was Bernard, he was professor of theoretical physics at Queen Mary College in London. So, you know, he was got cred as a scientist. Theoretical physicist, close associate of Stephen Hawking. So, he told me of this experiment which one of his friends devised in Imperial College in London. That is, again, one of the top science and technology colleges, part of London University. And in this experiment, he claimed that he would demonstrate levitation. And this was a scientist with a lot of cred. So, he managed to convince many of his friends, top physicists, lecturers, experimenters, to come to this demonstration of levitation. Well-known leading scientists. And sitting in the lecture theater with the big bench in front, this presenter brought in a flower pot and he put it on the bench. There was no wires or anything. And he said, "We're now going to levitate this flower pot in laboratory conditions," had cameras on it, videoed it, but he said, "I need your assistance. I want you all to start chanting, Om." And one of his biggest successes was getting all these crusty conservative scientists all to chant, "Om, Om, Om." And as they were chanting, "Om," that flower pot lifted above the bench. It levitated. It was filmed. It was photographed. It happened. And at the end of the demonstration, he asked some of those seasoned experimenters who relied on objective reality to describe what they had seen. and a couple of them, what are you talking about? That flower pot stayed on the bench all the time. But the evidence is on camera. That is fake. It never lifted at all. Now, what had been happening underneath that bench was this huge, powerful electromagnet. And as you all know, when you turn on such a strong, powerful current of electricity, it makes a humming sound. The oming was there to mask the fact that a current was flowing through this huge magnet under the bench. Otherwise, they'd have all found out what was going on. But that was not the point of the experiment. The point of the experiment, these were physicists, seasoned, well-known scientists, who, because they had this view, it cannot happen. Levitation breaks every rule of physics and science which they've invested their career in, that they didn't even see it. It never appeared to their conscious awareness. There is no such thing as pure awareness. It is filtered before it even comes to our conscious attention. That is scary, but that is true. We literally see only what we want to see. And we just don't even see it. It doesn't come to our awareness when it totally goes against our worldview. If an alien spaceship landed in Chicago and they said, take me to your leader, they would not be taken seriously. Most people wouldn't even see it. It goes totally against our worldview. Therefore, we don't see it. The evidence is strong for reincarnation. And I would say, why don't scientists actually look at the evidence and see it? Because it can't exist. That's why it doesn't exist. We are blinded by our views. Be careful. One of my best friends was the Catholic abbot of a temple, of a local monastery, that's Abbot Placid. We became great friends, but he was also very mischievous, so was I. So when we went for another tour around this old monastery, I asked him, are there any ghosts in the monastery? He said, no, in Catholicism we don't believe in ghosts. I said, really, you don't believe in ghosts? He said, no. Nope. So what about the Holy Ghost? I was only teasing him. Or like that Australian girl. She went on holiday to UK. And I mentioned that, you know, if you go to UK, you have to go to castles. So she found a castle which was open. Hundreds of years old. Maybe almost 1,000 years old. And you look at your history books, some of the very nefarious, cruel, sadistic deeds done in those dungeons were terrible. So when she went into the lower parts of this old castle, you know, she felt chills all over her. The whole castle was the spookiest place she'd ever been. And even every door, as it went open, and any window, that's the best special effects I can do. And it was such a scary experience that at the end of the tour she had to ask the guide, are there any ghosts in this castle? And the guide said, in all the years I've lived in this castle, I've never ever seen a ghost. And so she asked the guide, how long have you lived in this castle? And the ghost replied, 300 years. Kids love that story. So you're all kids at heart. Well done. Okay. You mentioned fault-finding mind to be avoided, but it is the same as critical thinking or critical reasoning in the West, which seems to be a crucial quality required for modern business management. Ha! That is also wrong. Why is it, whether it's in a sports team or whether it's in a business, when something goes wrong, then we always have this big investigation? And we want to blame someone, sack somebody when it goes wrong. And what happens in business when that happens? Everyone loses their motivation. They get negative. Why, when things go wrong, we let it go? When things go right, we have a big meeting of why it went right. Number one, when we focus on the successes in a business or the successes in a sports match, if we could only focus on that, number one, we learn the secret of success rather than worrying about why it failed. And because we keep thinking and focusing on success, our motivation increases. We become a much better, more successful sports team or corporation when we focus and find out the meaning of success rather than the cause of failure. Relationships. When your husband turns up late for dinner, you never let him forget that. I don't know if you heard about Valentine's Day. You do Valentine's Day in US. The day before Valentine's Day, the husband turned to his wife and said, "What do you want for Valentine's Day?" And she said, "Nothing, darling, I've got you." He'd been married long enough to know that's not what she meant. "Now, I want to buy you something. You know, I want to buy you something special." So she looked at him and said, "Diamonds. Something with diamonds in." And he smiled at her and said, "Okay, darling." And on Valentine's Day, she opened this little present, wrapped in beautiful gift paper. She opened it up, and it was a pack of playing cards. 13 diamonds in it. Bang. That meant divorce. But, no, it's why is it when somebody makes a mistake, we obsess about it? We keep thinking about it again and again and again, and it causes the separation. The two bad bricks in the wall story. We focus on the 998 good bricks in the wall. The successes. Critical thinking is learning what works in life. We learn from successes much more than we ever learn from failures. Successes. You have a beautiful day together, husband and wife. Why? Why was it a beautiful time together? Learn from that. Keep focusing on what works, then have a very happy time together. What fails, I just push that aside. Water the flowers, not the weeds. Dhirajampram, restlessness. I experience this often in my mind and body when I try to meditate, just like when I tried to stop my sexy thoughts, and they just got worse. Let them be. And that's when restlessness stops. And I've been trying for literally years, oh, you poor thing. Suggestions. Give up. This is, any of you who have again read all the stories in Buddhism, there was Ananda. He was the, we're supposed to meditate, aren't we? Oh, crikey. Oh, we've got another 5 minutes to meditate before we have a tea break. Okay, but anyway, no, you fall asleep if you meditate now. So, last little question, and we have a tea break, and then we'll actually do some meditation. So, Ananda. He was a Buddha's attendant for 25 years. And so all these people coming up to become enlightened. All these people, and the Buddha said, "Yeah, well done. You're enlightened. You know, you've got these amazing powers and stuff."
And this Ananda fellow, getting nowhere. And then the Buddha died. Oh my goodness, if I can't get enlightened, when I'm next to the Buddha, day in, day out, as his attendant, what hope is there for me now? So he started getting depressed. But then what happened next was, the senior monks decided to have a big meeting to collect all of the teachings together. And so they had wanted that limited to 500. And of course you get the enlightened ones, you know, they're the elites. So they managed to choose a delegation of 500, and 499 of them were fully enlightened. And they wanted to include Ananda simply because he'd been the Buddha's attendant and learned so much. So imagine his predicament. The following morning, he'd be in a meeting with 499 fully enlightened beings, and he was the odd man out. To appreciate what this means, imagine at the end of this retreat at 5 o'clock, I made the announcement that every one of you was fully enlightened with psychic powers, except for you. How would you feel? That sucks. I've been coming to this place for such a long time, supporting people, really meditating for years, and these blow-ins come in here and they get enlightened the first time. That really is unfair. So that's what Ananda felt. So that night, before the meeting, he decided to give it everything he got. Enlightenment or bust. No namby-pamby sleeping, he's going to go for it. If ever you try that, enlightenment or bust, I guarantee it's always bust. When the dawn came, he was as stupid as ever. So, a little bit depressed, disappointed, he just gave up. He just decided it's time enough to go to bed, have a quick nap. So he decided to go to bed for an hour before the meeting started. And before his head hit the pillow, he became the 500th enlightened being. Why? Because he let go. That story I said earlier about the carrot and the donkey, I did say that yesterday, didn't I? Some people say yes, some people say no. Did I? Didn't say it. Okay, very quickly, the donkey and the carrot. That's how Ananda got enlightened. Donkeys pull carts, but they're stubborn. If you try and hit the donkey on the back with a stick, it doesn't move. That's not how you get the donkey to pull the carrot. Instead, you tie that stick to the back of the donkey's neck, so the front of the stick is 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick, you tie a string, and on the end of the string, you tie a carrot. So the donkey sees a carrot 2 foot in front of its mouth. Donkeys like carrots, so it moves forward. It's called incentive. So you see the carrot moves forward. But as a donkey moves forward, the stick moves forward, the string moves forward, and the carrot moves forward. You can see it, you can smell it, but you just can't reach it. Does that sound familiar? The perfect relationship, success in life, the wonderful salary, the greatest home, enlightenment. You can see it. It's right there. And you go forward and it moves away from you. And that's especially true of meditation, enlightenment, the whole works. You can see it, you can understand it, but you just can't reach it. Why? But the donkeys have worked out how to catch the carrot. It's so obvious when you see it. So what does the donkey do? It's already been running after that carrot, but the donkey reads the mindfulness bliss and beyond out there and learns how to stop, to let go. So the donkey suddenly stops. Momentum. The carrot moves further away from you. Just like when you let go, you fall asleep. You say, this can't be right. I'm moving further away from enlightenment. Or you get restless. Or your kid leaves home for the first time. Bye-bye, mummy, I'm leaving home. You let it go. The meditation, enlightenment, is further away than ever before. But you wait in the moment. You are patient. you have trust. And soon that cow is 4 foot in front of your mouth. Never been as far away before. And then something happens. It starts coming towards you. You just sit there, do nothing, and all these incredible states of meditation, they just come to you. Soon it's 2 foot in front of you, but now coming at top speed towards your mouth. You know, you stop, swing, up, down, but you've got to remember, many people make this mistake. Because many times a donkey, it bounces off its teeth. They forget compassion, kindness. Carrot, the door of my mouth is open to you. That is how you catch carrots. You stop, and a carrot comes towards you. That is how Ananda became enlightened. He was running after enlightenment so fast, giving everything he got, and then gave up. When he gave up, the carrot came towards him. Thank you. And in that story, because he was enlightened, he got all these amazing psychic powers as well. You know, sometimes you get these free gifts in the cornflakes packets. Don't ask for them, they just come. And he wanted to convince all his friends, the other 499, he was enlightened. So he deliberately came late. When they locked the door, they thought he was late, wasn't going to come. They locked the door, and he came into the meeting through the keyhole. It's called making an entrance. And everybody realized, wow, yep, nice one, Ananda, you're enlightened. So, if any of you really want to prove that you're fully enlightened, when the place is locked up tonight, come in through the keyhole. That is awesome. Okay, so now we do 10 seconds meditation. Okay, then now we can have a tea break.